It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Zimbabwe was once considered to be the jewel of southern Africa, but that is no longer the case. The new book, Hope Deferred, Narratives of Zimbabwean Lives, brings us the stories of the people who have lived and struggled through Zimbabwe's tragic decline. Peter Orner is here with me today. He edited this collection of interviews, co-edited the collection. He's also a visiting professor at the University of Iowa Writers Workshop. Peter, thank you for being here this morning.
Thank you, Charity, for having me.
The world watched the Zimbabwean elections of 2008, so a lot of us have a little bit of familiarity with the struggle for democracy in Zimbabwe and how that played out in 2008, and we'll get into what happened during those elections and the aftermath of those elections in a little while, but I want to go further back into the nation's history, and let's go back to 1980, when things looked really good for the country of Zimbabwe. What was going on at that time, and why did the future look so bright?
Well, in 1980, they were coming out of a very brutal civil war that went on for many, many years. And finally, a peace deal was brokered, and through many complicated manifestations, it emerged that Robert Mugabe was going to lead the country. And Mugabe had been in prison. He was a man of great education, kind of an intellectual. And I think that the spirit of the country was, they were very proud that they had come out of this terrible, terrible civil war to rally around one man, they became one nation. And things went sort of off the rails fairly quickly, although it wasn't really known throughout the world until, maybe a decade later. But things looked good, and Zimbabwe had a good education system, a very good healthy economy, and a strong agriculture sector. So things looked pretty good. And if you compared that to South Africa, which was in apartheid at that time, people were looking at Zimbabwe as kind of a beacon.
Well, let's talk about when things started to go wrong. And as you mentioned, things started to go wrong pretty quickly under the Mugabe rule, but people didn't know about it. And one of the first things that started to happen was something of an ethnic cleansing, really, in the southern provinces. Tell me what happened.
Well, what happened was, like a lot of dictators, like autocrats, Mugabe wanted to consolidate his power. He didn't want to share it. And basically, there was dissent, especially in the southern part of the country, some dissent, and he crushed that incredibly brutally. The historians say that as many as 10,000 people were killed, mostly of Ndebele origin, the minority group in the country. And it was an incredibly brutal time known as the Gakurahundi that has basically been a period in Zimbabwean history that hasn't been talked about. What's interesting is now it's starting to emerge, and many people that we talked to for our book spoke about the Gakurahundi openly for the first time. It had always been murmured about in families, but the stories are incredibly horrific of what went on at that time, and that was in the 80s. So already Mugabe's forces were doing this kind of thing. And this was at a time when, again, the world was celebrating Zimbabwe, and we didn't quite know what things were like. The outside world didn't within the country. Of course, in Matabele land, they knew.
Right. And the Mugabe government was justifying these actions, although, of course, even within the country, people didn't know the extent of what was going on, justifying these actions as saying that they were seeking out traitors and punishing traitors.
Exactly. And again, time and time again in recent Zimbabwean history, that's been the call. You accuse people of being traitorous, and then you go after them, and you go after their families. And that we've seen that happening continually up until the present day, this week, in fact.
As time went on, another one of the big initiatives undertaken by the Mugabe regime was to change the ownership of the land in the country. And on the face of it, again, this doesn't sound so bad that, after years and years of colonial rule and a situation somewhat similar to what was going on in South Africa with apartheid, where there were white landowners who were very successful and had these big commercial farms, the Mugabe regime set out to redistribute that land. What went wrong with that scenario?
Well, I should say, having spent a lot of time in Southern Africa and South Africa, and I lived in Namibia, which is a country I love very much, for almost 2 years, and I was able to see firsthand that land has not been redistributed in Southern Africa, throughout Southern Africa. And in 1980, just to go quickly backward, there was discussion that land was going to be redistributed. There is a fairly small white population in Zimbabwe who were controlling much of the good agricultural land, most of it. And what happened was is basically Zimbabwe, Mugabe sat on his hands. He didn't do anything to redistribute that wealth until, and again, this is, you know, I'm a novelist. I'm not a historian or a political scientist, but just in terms of my own research and speaking to people in Zimbabwe, that it seemed that when things got politically dicey for Mugabe, he went after a very juicy target, and the white landowners in Zimbabwe are absolutely that. We interview two in our book. They're pretty straightforward about the kind of lifestyle they were living, and it was pretty great. So the idea of Mugabe going after white landowners was a politically advantageous one. The problem was is that it led to what seems to be have been a collapse of the agricultural sector, and the economy went with it after 2000. So he wanted short-term political gain. And again, as a good liberal like myself, redistribute the land. You know, I'm all for it. But what happened was it ended up impoverishing Zimbabwe in a way that we'd never seen before in that country.
Because the land was put in the hands of people who didn't know how to farm, or didn't have the education to farm, didn't have the tools to farm, weren't given any support to farm.
That's part of it. And again, and historians and researchers on the ground will say that there some good has come, and we talk about this in the book, that we don't want to make too black and white, that you took the land away from the whites, bad things happened. But that is true that a lot of people were given land that didn't quite know what to do. But more often the case, it seems to me, and again, my own personal opinion, that it had more to do with the fact that cronies got the land and didn't work it, and a lot of white farmers were chased away who were employing people and producing food. Again, our book deals with individual stories and individual takes on that. So we don't take a position on it, but we did talk to many people who were directly affected, and they had differing opinions. So, but that's one opinion, and certainly one that I share part of.
With the problems caused by the agricultural crisis in the country, the economy was already struggling. But then in 1999, it became a more difficult situation when war veterans began demanding compensation for all of the things that they had been through and received compensation. What happened there?
Well, the war veterans were pressuring for recognition. And again, these war veterans were people from the war in 1980, so it's arguable who's a war veteran, who's not. But Mugabe and the government of Zimbabwe was getting pressure from people who call themselves war veterans to be compensated for the sacrifices they made for their country. Again, very legitimate. That was tied into land redistribution, and a lot of the war veterans ended up getting some of those properties. What it did was is stir up passions in the country. And it became a political football with the opposition party and the government fighting over this. And often the opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change, was tagged as being sort of for white landowners and against war veterans, which the situation on the ground is obviously much more complicated than that.
And as things became more difficult for individuals, as food became more scarce, as the currency became devalued, the Movement for Democratic Change, the MDC, did gain a lot of followers. This looked like the way of the future. If they could get Robert Mugabe out of power and actually have a fair democratic election and elect Morgan Tsvangirai, that was, for many people, they saw that as the way out.
Absolutely. And that all came to a head in in international headlines in 2008.
Right, even though it had been a decade of struggle.
Right, absolutely, and the MDC had been around for many years. The MDC was gaining ground because of, people were looking for some alternative to a very corrupt and a very violent government that was controlling Zimbabwe for too many years.
With the elections in 2008, for people who don't remember exactly what happened, there was a vote. It was proceeding. It seemed to be a fairly free vote at some point. And it looked like Morgan Tsvangirai was going to win. What happened?
That's right. And in fact, it was a fairly free vote, and it was also a vote free of violence, at least the first time around. So, there were all these wonderful photographs of the statistics on the walls of the polling stations, which looked very much like the MDC was going to win this election. The government then put the whole thing on pause and stalled, and finally released a vote total that would mean that Tsvangirai didn't win outright and that there would have to be a runoff between Mugabe and Tsvangirai. That's when basically all hell broke loose in the country, because the thugs came out and the political violence was extremely brutal and ongoing, especially in rural areas where, there wasn't a lot of accountability. And so in Zimbabwe, one thing we learned in doing the book is that even apolitical people have to take a political position, that they find themselves caught up in this situation where, unless they're outwardly supporting the government, they're looked upon again as that word traitor. So in 2008, there was a great deal of violence that eventually led to Morgan Tsvangirai pulling out of the runoff, and basically Mugabe was running unopposed at that point, and that's where we are today, except for one more piece, which I can talk about.
And we will talk more about that in just a moment. My guest today is Peter Orner. He is one of the editors of a new collection called Hope Deferred, Narratives of Zimbabwean Lives. And it's a book made up of 25 interviews conducted with people either living in exile or still living in Zimbabwe who struggled through this tragic decline in the country. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about Zimbabwe. There's a new book out. It's called Hope Deferred, Narratives of Zimbabwean Lives, and it brings us the stories of 25 individuals who have lived and struggled through the decline in the country of Zimbabwe. My guest right now is Peter Orner, and he's one of the co-editors of this collection. And as we get into talking about the stories that you've collected, Peter, you're a novelist. Why are you involved in this project, and how did that come about?
The book, I should say, is part of a series of books published by McSweeney's Publishing in San Francisco, and the imprint is called Voice of Witness. And what Voice of Witness does is try and shed light on areas in the world where human rights violations are taking place. And I first got involved in Voice of Witness because I did a book about undocumented people living in the United States, and that stemmed from my own interest in immigration and the fact that in my other life I went to law school and got a law degree, and I never have practiced. I wrote fiction during law school, which is a good time to write fiction because it's so absolutely dull. But I did do some work in immigration asylum cases in San Francisco, and that led me to realize once again that I wasn't meant to be a lawyer, and I became involved in Voice of Witness because I thought it would be very interesting to, rather than litigate cases, which wasn't my skill level or skill set or something, but that I was more a storyteller. And so I suggested to McSweeney's and Voice of Witness that we do a book interviewing undocumented people. And that was called Underground America, and it came out a couple of years ago and has been, I think, a very helpful book in terms of people understanding the situation on the ground for undocumented people. just to make a very long story short, I've long been interested in Southern Africa, having lived there in the early 1990s, and wrote a novel about Namibia called The Second Coming of Mawile Chikongo. And when I was living in Namibia, I visited Zimbabwe, and I fell in love with Zimbabwe. And so after this project, this other oral history project, I thought that it might be wonderful to do a book that shed more light on what's going on in Zimbabwe. And I last piece of it, I got together with Zimbabwean Annie Holmes, who I hope calls in. She's in England right now. We hope she phones in. But Annie and I put this book together and worked on this book for 2 years together. So that's in a very small nutshell. I hope that helps.
When you visited Zimbabwe, you said you fell in love with it. What was it about the country that appealed to you?
Well, Namibia, which I also love, is the driest country in Southern Africa. And so I was living in the semi-desert, and I took a vacation to Zimbabwe, as a lot of people do. They go to Victoria Falls. It's one of the most beautiful falls in the world. And then I proceeded upward into the country and went to some incredible national parks and visited Harare and Bulawayo. This was in the early 90s, again, when things were happening in Zimbabwe, but as a tourist, I didn't know anything about it. And I thought, one, that it was incredibly, it was green and lush and beautiful in a way that I never had quite seen before in my life. Chimanimani National Park is, you know, the whole world should go and see that. And the other piece was is that it had a very vibrant literature. And as a writer, even then, I was so taken with the great Zimbabwean writers. And colonialism did such a number on Namibia and other parts of Africa that a lot of Namibian writers were suppressed. But in Zimbabwe, after 1980, the literature started to flourish. And I'll just name quickly, Dambudza Marachera is one of my favorite writers, Charles Mungosi, who we dedicated the book to, and Yvonne Vera, who was a wonderful writer who died a few years ago. So that was some of the reasons that I fell in love with Zimbabwe.
And one of the, in the book, you talk about how having a thriving literature world in a country is a symbol. It's really indicative that it's a strong, healthy nation with a strong intellectual base.
Absolutely. And Zimbabwe, you know, like many other countries in the world, has a very strong storytelling tradition. And that was absolutely flourished after 1980 and still to this day. In very, very difficult environment, there are still some wonderful Zimbabwean writers who are working in very difficult situations.
When the world watched this election in 2008 and the violence that exploded afterward, and of course, as we've mentioned, Morgan Tsvangirai dropped out of the runoff ostensibly because people were getting killed and he wanted that to stop, and
right.
he didn't see a way out. And some of the people in your book who supported Morgan Tsvangirai are angry about that because they felt a little abandoned at that point in their struggle. But when you started, you know, and as I mentioned, people were watching at that point, but you're talking about decades of human rights abuses, decades of torture, abductions, of rape, of murders that were going on. When did these stories start to come out about Zimbabwe?
Well, I think you put your finger on it earlier. When the land invasions, or whatever you want to call them, redistribution, just you pick your terminology, started to happen and the economy started to get bad, I think that people started to struggle, and I think that the stories started to emerge internationally. But again, Zimbabwe has we spoke to a human rights worker there who said that this is one of the most documented human rights crises in the world, Zimbabwe. It's been happening for a long time. It's been a very slow boil. This has been an extremely brutal regime. And it only, I think, has started to emerge internationally because the MDC has called attention to it, and Morgan Tsvangirai is going around the world talking about it. But these are things that, you know, even myself in the early 90s, I should have known if I'd done a little digging. I should have known what was happening under the surface of where I was.
How did you go about finding the people for this collection, the people to tell their stories?
Well, Annie Holmes, like I said, is Zimbabwean, and without Annie, this book would not have happened. And she and I took two separate trips to Zimbabwe in 2008 and 2009. and started to, I'm sorry, 2009, 2010, and started to collect people, basically, that we wanted to talk to. And we ended up talking to, I believe, about 60. And we would sit down with them, and myself, Annie, and a number of Zimbabwean interviewers, as well as some American interviewers who were in South Africa with us. And we started to, first of all, we were in South Africa, where we talk about this in the book, but millions of Zimbabweans have fled across the border into South Africa. So there are a large population of Zimbabweans in South Africa who we could speak to freely and openly, who, even though, and the situation in South Africa for them is very difficult, there's a lot of xenophobic violence that affects Zimbabweans in South Africa. We talk about this in one of our narrators, her name is Noctula, had some terrible experiences with xenophobia. But basically, you can speak a little bit more freely. And so we interviewed many people in Johannesburg and the Cape Town area, and also on the border of Zimbabwe in a South African town called Messina, which is basically the gateway for many hundreds of thousands of Zimbabweans to come across. They live in camps. We went up there, set up camp in a motel, and interviewed as many people who would talk to us. The second part of that is we went into Zimbabwe. I went in as a tourist visa. Annie went in as a Zimbabwean citizen. We stayed with friends of Annie's and radiated throughout the country and discreetly, quietly conducted many interviews in the country.
That sounds dangerous. There have been a lot of attacks on journalists in Zimbabwe, a lot of journalists sent out of the country. The BBC is not allowed to broadcast from Zimbabwe. No BBC journalists are allowed to enter the country, although I'm sure some still do on occasion.
Right.
What did you do to keep yourself safe while you were doing that?
Well, I think our biggest concern was just people getting in trouble talking to us. I think we were less concerned about our own safety. And frankly, there wasn't a whole lot of danger to us personally. I think we were such small fry. We're not the BBC or the New York Times, or we weren't calling attention to ourselves. We did not declare ourselves as journalists, and we were practicing journalism, which technically under the regime's laws is illegal. So true, but I think that what we were so conscious of was putting the people we were speaking to in danger. So we always made sure that we had our contacts secure, and that the people who were speaking to us knew that we were only doing this to get the stories out. And basically, we also agreed to conceal their identities, not just through changing their names, but in some cases changing the location and changing some key details that would identify them. So we were extremely careful about that. I think that, both trips, although there were times when, sure, I was a little worried about my own safety, our biggest concern was for our narrators.
Well, I want to talk about some of the individuals whose interviews make it into the mm-hmm. book, but you have a portion of the book that you'd like to read, and that'll give us a little bit of an understanding of how you organize the book and what you're saying in it.
Sure. The book is divided into eight sections, and you basically move around Zimbabwe and also the diaspora in South Africa, and we describe in small essays at the beginning of each section what it's like on the ground in the particular place that we conducted these interviews. So I thought I would go with Harare, the capital, which is a beautiful city, and huge trees lining the boulevards and green and just a wonderful place, although, as you can imagine, has been hit on very hard times with the economic trouble. So I thought I would read a little bit of the capital section and then a little bit of the voice of a narrator called Sanko. It's been raining in Harare for the last few days, and the city is overgrown and green. Summer weeds grow tall beside the roads, all as quiet as if the entire capital was holding its breath, waiting. Driving across Harare at night, there are a few streetlights. Headlights pick up people walking by the side of the road. Others walk straight down the median. Most traffic lights in town no longer function. They're just hollow eyes in the dark. Only a few other cars on the road. At intersections, people are polite, hesitant. You go. No, after you, please. Drive by Harare City Hall, completely dark. Drive by Harare General Hospital, completely dark. Only certain buildings, government buildings, have power tonight. notably President Mugabe's official residence in the center of town, State House, the lights of which are only dimly visible through the thick trees. Some statistics estimate that at least one-third of the Zimbabwean population has fled to neighboring countries, mostly South Africa, but also Mozambique, Botswana, Namibia, and also abroad. And every day, the Zimbabwean diaspora becomes larger. They're leaving because of systematic political violence, lack of jobs, the almost total breakdown of education and healthcare systems, and rising rates of deadly disease, most notably cholera. It's impossible to know if this one-third estimate is correct, but the city certainly feels emptier. This week, the government issued a trillion-dollar note, and again, this is 2009. This week, the government issued a trillion-dollar note. Yet no matter how often new denominations are issued, inflation keeps rising. Today's rate can be found on the chalkboard at a favorite coffee shop, 34 trillion Zimbabwe dollars to one American dollar. Word is, in the coffee shop, that soldiers are paid in bundles of cash that are dumped out of trucks like hay bales. Someone else mentions, laughing, that people are driving by State House and throwing Zim dollars out the window of their cars. And people laugh and laugh over the zeros. What choice do they have but to laugh? And now I'm going to switch, obviously, a much different situation. But this is we talked about the MDC and Morgan Tsvangirai. And I'm just going to read a little bit of a story from a man named Sanko. Sanko was a barber in a pretty rough area of Harare. He became politicized after not being able to make a living, and he joined the Movement for Democratic Change. And he's a pretty fearless guy. He's not a big guy. He's about my stature. And I interviewed him in Johannesburg, and he's very quiet. His voice would rarely modulate, even when he was talking about the most intense things. And we ended up spending hours and hours together. And he had a completely photographic memory, it seemed to me. And anyway, he'd been arrested countless times for his involvement in the MDC. He was actually one of the youth leaders he was in his 30s, but in Southern Africa, this happens in South Africa too, the youth wing of a political party is often people, you know, from 20 to 40, and then the old guard is the political party. So Sanko is known as quite a troublemaker, and he's known in his own political party, the MDC, and also in from the government. So the government picks him up one night, and he's being interviewed, and this is I'll pick the story up from there. In one of the rooms, they started to interview me. One cop came, smiling nicely at me, and said, "So how are you, Captain?" I kept looking at him. Then he said, "Why are you not answering, Captain?" And I said, "I'm not a captain. My name is only Chari. I'm not captain of anything." And the guy said, "Fine, you're joking again. But you're going to start telling us the truth soon." They took me to another police station, driving very fast. It was now around 1 o'clock in the morning when I was put into another cell. I was starting to sleep when I heard my name being called. I stepped out of the cell. I was grabbed and given a clap on the face. A crack below my right eye started bleeding. I tried to see, but I couldn't. I was handcuffed again, my hands behind my back, and taken out to a white Mazda B1800 pickup truck. At the back of the Mazda was a coffin. One of them opened it. He said, "What do you see?" There was a dead person inside. I told him what I saw. He said, "Yes, it's one of your MDC members. He is dead, and you are also dead." Then he took the corpse out and put it in the truck. Then he ordered me to go inside the coffin. They closed it and started driving. They drove and drove, maybe 40 minutes on a tar road. Then I could hear the bumpy road. Inside that coffin, I can't tell you what I was thinking. Say you're driving and you think you're about to have a head-on collision. Then you know that this is death. You definitely won't think anything. You won't even think of running away or whatever. You just think of how you're going to face it. Even right now, I don't feel like I'm alive. I don't really understand it. Even when I come across other people, I just feel like people are seeing a dead person. You look at me, and I feel dead. After some time, maybe hours, the vehicle stopped. I could hear voices, and somebody asked, "Where's that pit?" I'll stop there.
That's Peter Orner reading from one of the interviews that was conducted for the new collection, Hope Deferred, Narratives of Zimbabwean Lives. That was from an interview with a man named Sanko. And we'll talk more about his story and the stories of the others who are profiled in this book, whose stories are told in this collection. You're also welcome to join our conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today my guest is Peter Orner. He is a novelist, and he's also the editor of a new nonfiction collection. It's called Hope Deferred, Narratives of Zimbabwean Lives, and the book catalogs 25 interviews with different people from all walks of life who struggled through Zimbabwe's tragic, violent decline. And most of the people in this book, Peter, were interviewed outside the country of Zimbabwe. Most of the people in the collection were in exile, and you were just reading before the break from an interview with a man named Sanko, and he's living in Johannesburg, South Africa. And of course, he did survive the torture he received, but he has a very gripping and compelling story about what he went through. But one of the things that I noticed in a lot of these stories, and we'll talk more about this later, but a lot of these people worked so hard for democracy and knew they were risking everything, their lives, their families, their livelihoods. But a number of them still have hope, still believe that their work will pay off in the end.
It's very hard. I want to make one comment, though. The book's about 50-50 in the country and out of the country. So just we talked to a number of people still living this. And in fact, in some ways, it's harder to be out than it is in for a lot of people. But I should say that, you know, we titled the book Hope Deferred because one of our narrators, a man named Briggs, quoted the Langston Hughes poem, Dream Deferred. And as you also know, hope deferred is a biblical phrase from the New Testament. And, you know, I think there's something about sharing stories in themselves, even when they're awfully horrific and hard to hear. And this is not a book for the faint-hearted. But there is, I think, something about how we do this, how we share stories, that has to be the first step to coming out of a nightmare. And I think that, people, we heard from people how, you know, not that it was cathartic, because I don't, you know, this is not story as therapy hour, but the fact that people, one, the people were interested in not just hearing the details of what had happened to them in a violent way, but we were interested, these are 25 page stories roughly each, and oftentimes they are about someone's, the totality of their whole life, and they're not. We were very set that this was not going to be a book about victimhood, but a book about who someone was and what they endured, but also what they, you know, everything else about them, their kids, their families, their grandparents, their love for their home place. That, to us, was the main idea. So there's a lot of hope in that. Is it grim? Is the picture grim? You know, Mugabe's in his mid-80s now. He's not going to be around forever. What's the power vacuum going to be look like when he leaves? All sorts of things that are bleak, but we looked for things that weren't as well.
One of the other things that struck me as I read through these different interviews is that you worked very hard to really find people from all walks of life, from all sides of this struggle. And Aaron is an example of that. I know you did the interview with Aaron, and he was a soldier, which many of the people in your book would have considered him to be the enemy.
Absolutely. And we did that very deliberately. We wanted to, well, first of all, we got a tip that there was a soldier who was willing to talk about his experience. He was on the run. He fled the army at a certain point and then crossed the border. And Aaron was involved very directly in human rights violations. And myself and another interviewer named Doug Ford spent a day and a night with him trying to get to the bottom of what he'd done, because he was, of course, more interested in talking about his hardship in having to leave the army, but we wanted to know who he was. And he told us many things about himself, including that he'd been an orderly in a hospital and that that experience had been very important to him, but that he'd always wanted to be a soldier. And he was very proud of his service as a soldier, but that when he was called upon to do police work and fire on protesters, he eventually had to leave. But he tells us a terrible story of what soldiers do when they go into bars in rural areas and make people dance at the point of a gun. So we got some very compelling testimony from him.
And it's an opportunity to really get inside the head of someone who committed human rights violations, because reading Aaron's story, he has your sympathy, or he has my sympathy.
I think he deserves it to a point, and it's not to say we shouldn't judge what he did, but you know, I think there's some truth in the fact that, you know, the victims, and I use that word I'm not supposed to use, but the people who've been affected by this, it goes from top to bottom. Even the people in a position of power in Zimbabwe and other places where there's autocratic regimes are, to a certain extent, not forced, because I think they make certain choices, but are caught up in situations where, they know they shouldn't be.
So many of the people that are profiled in the book, that the interviews that are shared, you see the choices that they made. And it's fascinating to follow along the very difficult choices that a number of them had to make as they chose again and again to support the MDC, the Movement for Democratic Change, in spite of the fact that they knew that they were putting themselves at risk and they knew that they were endangering their families as well, and that the movements that they tried to take to separate themselves from their families so that their families wouldn't also suffer the consequences of their movement. But there are just heart-wrenching stories about that. And I want to talk a little bit about, you spent some time on the border of Zimbabwe, which is, of course, as we mentioned earlier, possibly up to a third of the residents of Zimbabwe have fled, have gone to surrounding countries. But there are so many more people who are trying to get out. What is it that stops them from leaving? Why is it so difficult to leave?
Well, we talked to a couple in the book. They're named Pamela and Temba, and they're actually in Harare. They run a cleaning business in Harare. And, they're starting businesses in the midst of this. Talk about hope. And, you know, they say very directly, we don't want to raise our kids in a refugee camp. We're going to put our head down and try and stay out of trouble and make the very best of it. Pretty apolitical people, although they certainly have. And again, everyone's in Zimbabwe has a political opinion, which is nice. I think we could use that here. But I think that a lot of people stay for the reasons you would think is, you know, their kids are in school some days, because often days the schools are closed. I should say that just to bring us a little bit up to date, and people don't know, is Morgan Tsvangirai ended up joining the government following that horrific election, and is now a part of something called the Government of National Unity. So. Which has not worked, basically. But certain things have gotten better. Schools have started to open, and the economy is starting to stabilize. But election violence is very much on the rise. So people who are there have the same situation you talked about. Why do they stay? You know, they're doing the best they can. But every day, new people are leaving.
Let's talk about some of the people that you talked to who along the border. And one of them is Bernard. Can you tell us a little bit about Bernard?
Bernard, very, very interesting man, Bernard. He was a banker. Now he works in the construction trade in Messina on the border, as you say. Bernard, again, we wanted to make a point where a lot of the people we talked to were very involved in politics. Sanko, the guy I spoke to about who'd been arrested and driven in the coffin. But Bernard was a guy who was, you know, much more interested in making money as a banker in Harare and doing quite well, and ends up almost peripherally becoming involved in politics. And that's how it happens. They think, oh, that guy's not quite on our side. Let's beat up Bernard. And one night Bernard was coming home from a birthday party, and some youths, he thinks ZANU-PF youths, which is Mugabe's political party, beat up him and his friends. And this is a guy who's very ambitious, highly educated, and finds himself in this great job. And then he's out of work. He can't work. And his parents, who are, again, very apolitical, very religious, they want him to put his head down and not make trouble. And he ends up being sort of the black sheep of his family because he's got to flee. And we met him just across the border. And Bernard, you know, we spent a lot of time with him. He was very worried. He was 25. He thought he was too old to get married. You know, he was too old. He would never get married. I had to assure him that he was still a young guy at 25. But anyway.
But when you say that, the life expectancy in Zimbabwe
is true.
Early to mid-30s.
That's true, although Bernard wasn't malnourished. I mean, he was a very healthy person. We wanted to have a totality of people. So oftentimes what ends up being part of these stories is people's own, you know, who they are beyond the fact that he was beaten up after that mm-hmm. party.
Well, and there are many stories also by women in this collection.
Yes.
We haven't talked so much about them mm-hmm. because these are not the interviews that you conducted. And these women had to tell very personal, tragic stories. Many of them were raped. One of them wound up working in internet pornography South Africa. There are women who ended up having to become prostitutes because they couldn't make a living any other way. So this collection does represent a broad array of experiences and stories.
Absolutely. And I'll just break in and say that, you know, that in a situation like this, women always have it the worst. I think that's true. Not necessarily because they're always, in some cases, they're very involved in politics in this book, but also people who just had to flee for economic reasons or violence in their communities and had to run across the border. What happens is when people are in movement like that, they're prime targets for predators. And as you said, Violet ended up in internet porn in Johannesburg. Rudo, another of our narrators who I actually did interview, told me horrific stories about what it was like once she finally found a shelter in Johannesburg and then had to survive. And she was raped in that shelter.
People talk about victim fatigue, hearing stories about terrible things. And of course, we've all been hearing terrible stories out of many different parts of Africa our entire lives. And I think there is some fatigue that goes along with that. You think, well, the whole continent's a mess, which is obviously not the case. But by telling these individual stories, are you hoping to break through that fatigue that people experience about hearing the statistics about, you know, the number of children who die each year, the number of rapes that take place, the number of people who are displaced?
Absolutely. And one of our points of making a book out of Zimbabwe is that Zimbabwe is completely unique, and it's a completely man-made crisis. We're not talking about a famine. We're not talking about anything environmental. We're talking about a purely abusive power. And, you know, that I don't think is a, you know, I agree with you. I think people are fatigued and they hear Africa and they hear basket case. But Zimbabwe is a completely unique situation, as are, of course, every country in Africa. And I think, you know, I hope we're starting to get past this. And that's part of our point.
When people hear these stories, I think there's also a sense of helplessness. We would all like to help people who are suffering. But what can individuals actually do that would make a difference in Zimbabwe?
That's a great question, and it's come up in a lot of the events that we've done, and people have asked us, okay, well, you made your point. Now what can people do? And I can refer you. One is to our website, voiceofwitness.org, and we have 10 things you can do for Zimbabwe, which we, in anticipation of people asking this very question. Among them, probably the first and foremost for me, is to learn about what's happening there and to put pressure on, you know, our government to hold Zimbabwe more accountable than they do. It's been a while since we've heard much comment about Zimbabwe from the very top of our government, and I think we should. And there's a number of organizations working, and this is what I think I should make very clear about Zimbabwe, is that in spite of the fact that it's an autocratic regime, that, you know, they're out there looking at you all the time, there are a number of courageous organizations working on the ground every day in the open, often arrested, but sometimes brought back in the open, trying to make things better there. And I would just refer you to one website in particular that some friends of ours run called kubatana.net. That's KUBATANA.net. It's a wonderful women's organization in Zimbabwe that is working to alleviate some of the horrible things that have been going on.
One of the stories that struck me most in this book is about a young man named Briggs. He's 30 years old, and he's living in Washington, D.C. right now, or at least he was while this book was being written. And he is married. He has a 2-year-old son who was born in the United States. He was a director, or he is director of campaigns for Africa Action. He's also a former student leader in Zimbabwe. And Briggs and his wife are planning to move back to Zimbabwe with their son, which, as a parent, really that overwhelms me with his courage and hope for the future, that he wants to raise his child in Zimbabwe.
Well, Briggs is a very brave guy, and if you read his story, which is extremely compelling, and you know we had to cut a lot of it because Briggs is so his depth of knowledge is so amazing. His opinions were so iconoclastic in a lot of ways. I mean, he's one of the people who says, you know, who will give you a totally different take on the land situation than a lot of the other narrators in the book. Briggs is somebody who, you know, who Zimbabwe needs. And, you know, I have great fears for his own personal safety if he does move back, because he is somebody who's been involved. But Briggs is going to do what Briggs is going to do, and I wish him well.
What is your hope for this book, for these stories as they go out into the world?
I think just the most elemental one is that we want people to get to know people they didn't know before. And you know, like any good book of fiction, any story collection, there's a great depth of character here. And these people are real. But we want you to, as you said, you know, that you felt for Aaron. That makes me, you know, feel quite good, even though Aaron was pretty honest about the things he'd done. And the person he's become since the things he'd done. But that's the main thing, is to know these people and to have some greater depth of knowledge of their own lives and what they've endured in Zimbabwe.
Peter Orner, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Peter Orner is the co-editor of a new collection called Hope Deferred, Narratives of Zimbabwean Lives. The book tells the stories of 25 individuals who have survived and lived through Zimbabwe's tragic decline. He's also a visiting professor at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Ryan Garvey. Podcasting and on-demand audio are available on our website, iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, The Life and Times of Alexander the Great. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.